Good evening and welcome to Writers at Warwick, a very special Writers at Warwick tonight. When I was first asked to chair tonight's event, I was thrilled. But then I was told that I had to introduce one of the most prolific writers in less than 1 minute. So thrill turned to panic. The task seemed impossible until I realized that, in fact, having published 20 novels, 5 collections of short stories, several children's books, non-fiction books, magazine articles, and a number of plays written for television, radio, and the stage, having been shortlisted for the Booker Prize for Praxis, won the Penn Macmillan Silver Pen Award for Wicked Women, and being awarded a CBE in 2001, tonight's guest needed no introduction. This evening, she will be talking to us about her latest publication, part memoir, part fiction. Mantrapped is fascinating and is sure to become a bestseller. So please join me in welcoming Faye Weldon.
Well, thank you very much. Would that it were to become a bestseller. Bestsellers tend to be Harry Potter or nothing these days, you know. And as many of the things I write, it's a strange mixture of not the popular, but the accessible and the inaccessible, posing as the accessible, also I like to think. I'm going to start reading this book because it will then show you, I think, by the end of it, what I am about in it, or how I am writing, or how it's a book. It's a book as well as just as about plot, as about structure and form, or I think that's what it is. It was very difficult to write. Most novels I write in a year and think that's rather a long time. This took me 2 years and rather difficult years, full of self-doubt and apprehension. However, this is how we begin. It's Tricia Leaves Home. Tricia had been rich and Tricia had been poor, and she knew it was better to be rich. Now she was to be poor again. The mattress Tricia slept upon was the most expensive on the market. She took consolation from that. Madonna had one like it. Tricia bought it after she won the lottery 9 years back. The claims the manufacturers made for it were true. When she woke in the morning, her joints were not stiff and she had no trace of back pain. She might on occasion wake weeping, but she did not wake hurting. Now she was to ache again. There would be no room in her new abode for so large and lavish a bed as hers. She had thought herself so resolved and steady of purpose, so unsentimental, so unattached to belongings, but now suddenly she felt weak at the knees and wanted to cry. She was alone in the world without even a decent bed or permanent pillow on which to lay her head. Life once had seemed so easy. You did your best and it worked out all right. The advertisement in the catalogue had shown a young woman sitting alone on a bed with a glass of wine sitting beside her on the pink and gold floral fabric of the mattress. It had passed the wine glass test, proving how the springs adjusted themselves to sudden changes in the distribution of weight. That was how life ought to be, glossy and properly worked out for those who had the money. Now, 9 years later, when push had come to shove and the creditors were banging on the door and everything had to be sold, she looked at the mattress and doubted that it was even saleable. There is not much of a market for used mattresses in a prosperous society. The suspicion is always there that the previous owner has died upon it and that it would be more auspicious to start afresh. And the mattress, Tricia could see, showed all too much evidence of a hard, living, ongoing life, far too much for a potential customer's comfort. It was stained with the traces of 9 years of careless living, flecked by blood and semen, marked by the breaking waters of pregnancy. It was impregnated, if she put her nose to it, with the soft fumes of marijuana and the acrid after-sense of cocaine. People had got so fussy, not just about things, but about their bodies. Once a woman would have been happy to look as God decided. Virtue lay in playing a good hand, no matter what cards were handed out at birth. Greasy hair, put up with it, big nose, large bottom, too bad, smile and be grateful. Now it was off to the cosmetic surgeon to defy God's will. Bodies were kept under better control than once they were. They were thinner, cleaner, better exercised, healthier. People of the new millennium had the energy and will to keep the corners clean. This was a mattress from the former age, the old century, and it showed. If a cover had come with the mattress, and at that price it surely should have, she had never bothered to put it on. The help never spoke English, and Tricia wasn't one to ask and burden servant lives further with extra toil. Sheets were understood in Latvia and Estonia, but mattress covers? She, Tricia, did not have the gift for creating order around her, and she was prepared to admit it. In her new life, she would try to do better. In the months after the lottery win, she had bought and bought and bought all the things she'd ever done without to make up for years of too thin saucepans, too cheap sheets, badly stitched clothes, and over-perfumed soap. She had bought the best and not thought about money other than to avoid bargains. Now everything had to be sold and would go for a fraction of what she had spent. But the pleasure of the antique Buddha, the double-pile carpets, the cocktail cabinets, the ice-making fridge, the serving table which talked back to you and wiped its own surface clean, the little unauthenticated Picasso sculpture of a bull had lain in the buying, not the owning. So who cared? The money had run out and credit too. Now she would earn her own living like everyone else. She was not new to penury. She had scraped along for years on benefits and occasional work as an actress. Now she would take a computer course and do temping, forget how much she hated office work, being cooped up. Others managed, so would she. It had been good to win the lottery, good to attract the men who went with it, but it would be good to live honourably once again. The nouveau riche were lonely. They looked over their shoulders all the time to make sure no one was cheating them, taking advantage. But they did tend to look in the wrong direction. Those born rich had it easier. They knew the rules and how to keep them, were trained at their nanny's knee never to break into capital, never to lend money, to stick to their own class, rules devised over centuries for their protection. It was only recently she had realised what capital was. It was the stuff in the bank which others more secure than she lived on. But she had her assets, people liked her, she was 44 but could pass for 10 years younger. She had good long skinny legs. And so I go on for a bit. And then she has a kind of discussion with the young auctioneer who's come to her, put everything on the market for her. And she's wondering about the mattress, and I haven't decided, she says to the auctioneer, it might come with me. Won't fetch much in a sale, he said. Mattresses never do. But I could take it off your hands for a fiver. It would clean up. My girlfriend's only got a futon. Perhaps he wasn't so bad. They were all in the survival game together. Now we come to writer's note. So far, so good. You can start a novel like this. Lottery winner faces hard times. Rags to riches is better, but riches to rags will do. It is heartening in fiction to watch people making good, but facing up to their just or unjust deserts has its attractions too. I remember thinking this in the days of my frivolity, when I was the BBC's darling, and anything I could think of to write they would produce without argument or committee meetings or worry about ratings. In the days when script editors were there to make writers happy and bring them cups of tea and not tell them what to do, and my income was great by my standards, even though my debts were often greater. That lasted for 15 years on and off and ended in the mid-80s. And then I go back to the novel, Tricia and her mattress, and I go on and on about this mattress, but it's a way of sort of getting into it, you know, and kind of describing her and what's going on in her head. Then I go riches to rags, and then we have a little piece. I came to the riches to rags idea in a taxi on my way to a commissioning meeting at the BBC. That was in 1985. I was unprepared. I would have to wing it, and did. Well, I said, there was this woman living happily in the country when, and made it up as I went along. Okay, they said. These days I would need to take along a 20-page synopsis fully illustrated to such a meeting, and the life would have gone out of it before I even began. That was The Heart of the Country, which ended up a TV miniseries and which I later novelised. And so I proceed through the book, sort of going back to the story, which is a kind of high-concept story. My Tricia actually passes a young man, a new-age young man, a new young man, on the stairs above the dry cleaner where she is obliged to make her home, and their souls swap. And at the bottom of the stairs, she finds herself a man, and at the top of the stairs, he finds himself a woman, and it's how they get on that is the nub of the story. But through the story, I sort of interweave with sort of excuses for the interweaving, really. It's rather hard to explain this novel to people, because it's not just a novel, it's a memoir, and it's also a sort of an autobiography, quite straight, of the of 15 years of my life between 76 and 80, I think. I wrote an autobiography called Auto da Fe, which stopped rather abruptly in 1976 when I began writing, and stopped there. And this takes the next section of life and writes about that, but relates it much more to actually the writing life or what I was doing at the time. But it stops in... this one stops in 19... God, I can't even... You know, I can't get these dates straight. It's always a problem. But anyway, it's the next section of my life. I don't want to bring it too far up to date, because I have the terrible feeling that if I ever do, I will just simply die. So with that, I will leave you. You now know the kind of thing that you and I are talking about.
Thank you very much. You sort of answered my first question about the structure of the novel. It's a very intricate structure, and I think everybody will be fascinated about how you try to interweave fiction and autobiography. So I would like to move on to my second point.
Yeah.
Could you try and explain to me and to the audience to which one of the plots, the autobiography or the novel, does the title refer?
It refers to both, I hope. I mean, Mantrapped is my Tricia, who is a rather dissolute kind of person, really, without any intellect at all. But she finds herself trapped in a man's body, and trying to deal with that and come to terms with that, and also because her soul is different. Now, soul is rather a difficult thing to write about, because let alone describe, because it's something we know is there but is actually undefined, and she no longer has hers, and so she is adrift. Now, when I talk to you about this, I realise the frailty of the book itself, because it does depend upon that, and I don't know how well I explore that at all. When you come to the autobiography, it's because you wonder why you're writing this. I wonder why I'm so exercised about mattresses until you relate it to various incidents which happened 20, 30 years ago in your own life. And you come to the conclusion, as you write this book, that there is no such thing as novel. It is all a kind of peculiar form, a peculiar, almost perverse form of autobiography. Now, for years, I would deny that anything I wrote was autobiographical. I would deny it almost hysterically. I would say, if any of this were true, you person there in the audience, I would be in prison or in a madhouse or dead. And they kind of believed me, but I now have to come clean and say, well, actually, yes, I think there is a very close relationship between what you write and what you have experienced yourself. What you are trying to do when you write fiction is actually disguise the fact that you're writing autobiography. So in this book, I come clean.
Okay, so we will read Tricia, keeping you in mind as well.
Well, yeah, it's a part of me. I hate to think that I'm this kind of, you know, rather foolish, drunken lottery winner, but if, you know, that's who spent all her money. But, you know, if you want to see this as me, carry on. I'm prepared to accept this description as well, you know.
Well, I accept that. That's why I want to ask you a question that's I'm very grateful that I'm talking to you today so you can clarify one aspect of the novel. When I picked up Auto da Fé, I, like other curious people about celebrities, look at the photographs in their autobiographies first. And I want to see you when you're 5 years old, and I want to see your mum and dad. And that did the job. But then I picked up this, which is part memoir, and there were no photographs at all. What happened?
Well, I gave them some photographs, but they said they weren't good enough, do you know? And I hate to tell you this, you would be writers here, but publishers are very like that. You know, there's something about printing costs or some theory they have about how you must never put photographs in a novel or pictures, you know, of the writer in a novel, because then all hell would break loose and, you know, the bounds, the difference between autobiography and fiction would be lost. They're very happy to put photographs in autobiography and want them. But I did hand them this little bunch of photographs, which I thought were very relevant, and I loved to see them because they were photographs of my children when young, and that's all, you know, that's always nice to see. But they didn't want them and they didn't use them. And I'm glad you see it as a loss, because I told them if people would say that.
Yes, it certainly is. I thought it was a loss for sure. Well, still keeping with the idea that this is partly autobiographical and there were facets of your life in there, certainly your life has been very rich and very busy. And you have written a lot about love and loss. And in looking at these various plots that you've told us about, was there a particular story of love and loss that you felt was very difficult to write?
Yes. Self-revelation is difficult, and for the writer, I think fiction may well be just a retreat from facing head on. You face it sideways and bring other people with you. But yes, I think it is. I think it is there. Writing autobiography is difficult anyway, because you have a peculiar, very complex duty. You feel when you write it, you have a duty to speak the truth and not to tell lies. But knowing the truth about yourself is never necessarily easy or pleasant. And you also have to worry about the people you don't want to hurt or say too much about. And you would say far more in conversation to your friends than you do about members of your family or what. But you don't want to do that, so you don't do it. While yet you have to keep to the essence of what's going on. I mean, life is far more sort of horrendous than appears in even an autobiography, as one knows when you read the autobiographies of other people. You have the feeling of how much of the personal has to be kept out if you're going to go about in normal society.
Certainly, I felt. You should tell me if this is a difficult question and you don't want to talk about it. But certainly I felt that you, from Auto da Fé and onto Man Trap, there was a very difficult relationship you had with your mother. And I think this is actually the fact for most women, that we do have a difficult relationship being a mother and with our mothers. Do you think the act of writing helps you come to terms?
No, I don't think the act of writing helps you come to terms with anything at all. It just sort of scrapes the surface of old wounds. There's no health in it, really. You just do it on some impulse. I had actually, in the end, a very good relationship with my mother. But, do you know, mothers are guilty too. Mothers are very competitive with daughters, you know, you mustn't forget that. You know, they're all people, we're people, they're people. This relationship is not necessarily all important, just as the relationship between men and women is not the fact of the relationship, it's the individuals which are really coming into play here, and how two people manage to live under the same roof, which can be quite difficult.
Certainly. Well, will there be another memoir?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm doing now. You see, I started to write a proper novel. I owe my publishers three novels because I'd signed a unpaid because I'd signed a 6-book contract, and I thought I'd signed a 3-book contract. I had a very, you know, and I thought I was up to date, but they sort of paid. They pay me a kind of salary. It's a really complicated arrangement, and I'd sort of the time had gone by, and I was 3 novels short. So now I'm writing 3 novels, and I try to write quick novels, but it doesn't work like that. You just write a novel, I'm afraid. And I started to write this novel because they want a novel. They don't want one of these odd hybrid books, really. They just want a novel. If we're booksellers, know where they can put it in the shelves. Auto da Fe, which was an autobiography, was always in the fiction shelves. And I don't know where they're going to put this one, you know. But anyway, that is not the kind of thing the publishers like. They wanted a novel. Now, I have sort of, you know, and I've got 3 chapters into the novel, and I'm yearning, I'm longing, you know, to put some of my own experience in straight. The novel is actually about a young couple of very sort of rigorous and politically correct and anxious about the morality of everything they do, which is nice. Young couple, and they're not married on principle, and though they love each other. And then she has a baby, and she gets an au pair, and the au pair, I'm afraid, just moves in and takes over, and she ends up without child or husband or home or partner and home, with this girl sort of sitting there, sort of smirking, because she's so nice and such an idiot. But anyway, what I longed to do was to sort of, because I had had 4 children, and various people at various times of my life have helped me bringing them up. And I wanted to sort of give my experience of these girls and direct, but you can see that the publishers wouldn't want that, though you long to do that. Mm. You find yourself having to disguise it as fiction, but you don't want to. So what I did was you can be quite cunning about these things. I thought I would relate it from the girl's great-grandmother, from the baby's great-grandmother, who is actually giving an account of her own life, but disguised as of my life, but disguised as my sister, which I didn't have. I mean, I did have one sister, but I was once sort of sheltering from the press. My mother was terribly good in some ways. I was living in a little cottage with her at the point my marriage was breaking up, and there was sort of press hammering at the door, and we could be seen in the window of this little cottage, sitting, my mother and I, having lunch. And there came this knock at the door, and she just pushed me into the cupboard and shut the door and then said I wasn't there. She was very good, very quick off the mark. And then another time they came, and I didn't know it was them, and I opened the door. They sort of thrust a bunch of flowers in your hand and say, oh, we're so sorry for whatever it is that's happened, liars. And I said, no. And they said, you fair world. And I said, no, I'm her sister Frances, whom I made up at the spot. But I'm now using Frances as a real person whom I can fictionalize, but will still have all my experiences, because Frances lived next door to me for a long time. Do you know? So it still is going to look like a novel, but actually that part of it will actually be. This must sound very odd, really. All of you, it really must. Anyway, I can only tell you what happens in my head and on the page.
Well, we won't tell the publisher that it's autobiographical. Perhaps I'll open up to the audience.
Yes.
I could carry on talking all night, but I will open up to the audience and see if anyone, many people, want to ask some questions.
Yes. Well, I've always been, I mean, I never claim, I mean, I think I am a feminist writer in that I write about women, and I'm interested, you know, this is what interests me in the relationship between men and women is what interests me. So when they call me a feminist, I don't object. They call me that as a sort of marketing ploy when I began. You know, so that, you know, you don't, I never really knew what a feminist writer was, because I was certainly never writing propaganda. I was just writing accounts of fictionalized and focused accounts of the world as it was at the time. So you're labeled feminist, and I'm too proud to deny it, and I wouldn't want to. Feminists, though, these days, I mean, Holly Toynbee described me as the Winnie Mandela of the feminist cause. I mean, you know. they can get ever so angry. Do you know? Then sort of 2 or 3 years later, she's saying exactly the same thing. You know, I mean, everybody does. So that's the feminist bit. What was the other one?
Memoirs.
Oh, the memoirs. Well, again, you see, I never did English literature. I did economics. I don't know the difference between a memoir and an autobiography. I say it's an autobiography. They say an autobiography goes on till you're dead, to which I reply, well, how can you write if you're dead, you know?
Yes.
But that was mostly because I ended it when I was 33 instead of when I started the first one. I ended it rather suddenly because I'd written so much by then. And it seemed a very good point to stop. I can see why they get fed up with me, really, you know. But yes, it's memoir. It is memoir. This is overtly part novel, part memoir, linked together rather ingeniously, though they appear to be very different subjects. I mean, they are, and yet they're the same thing. And it is this attempt to make them the same thing or to justify this rather odd excursion of mine into this hybrid form, which has made Mantrapped what it is. But it's very readable. I mean, I do think people can read it without worrying about, you know, the absurdity of the whole thing, really. But it was difficult to write. It was difficult to write because, actually, oddly, one thing didn't lead to another, and yet it was inevitable that this was what you were going to write. There is, when you write novels, a kind of sense of, not all novels, but most, a sort of sense of the inevitable, that it's going to be written, so you just have to sit down and write it, and hard work it is, and, you know, that's it. So, feminist is in the eye of the beholder, I think.
It is actually highly readable and fascinating because it's wonderful how you let the story unfold and then you give up telling your story and let Tricia take over towards the end.
Yes.
I think it works very well. Mm. Fascinating.
Well, they're just more lives, you see, really, aren't they? More lives.
Absolutely. Yes, please.
Can I ask what sort of books you read?
Louder, please.
Can I ask what sort of books you read? Do you read novels?
Yeah, I read novels all the time. People send me novels, and I kind of have to read them. I read novels, and I do a certain amount of book judging, so I just read novels. But I started reading fiction. I just read. I was born a reader rather than a writer. You end up being a writer because you're writing the book you want to read, and nobody else has done it. And there is a sort of hole in your, you know, there's a hole, and the need to fill it is very great. So I read a lot of contemporary novels. I read novels that I have to write forwards to, like, but it does become a kind of work. Like, I'm doing the foreword to Aldous Huxley's Not Brave New World, Antiquay. And this I find extraordinarily interesting, and forwards to Jane Austen's early works, various others I've done. And Thackeray, and you then have to read the book, because, as I say, not doing English literature, you didn't do that, but then you have to read it, and a great pleasure it is, and you do realise why these books have lasted is because they are just good books, good writing, good stories, good everything, which enlighten you as to the nature of the world around you. I read these because I have to. On the train, I live in Shaftesbury, and I'm in London quite a lot, and I go back on the train and I buy books at W.H. Smith, and then Nick, my husband, goes to all the village fates and buys up all the lots of books, and so I've read a lot of 1950s and 60s science fiction, which I love. And then there are all these General's memoirs and the fall of Singapore and the fall of Constantinople, and, you know, all this is really good, rich stuff. Unfortunately, I have become over the years a very fast reader, or, you know, otherwise you couldn't do this. And I write and I read, and I if I go to my publishers, they hand me books they've just bought out, which they think I might, you know. So there's no shortage of books. I just read a book by a French young French writer called Bible Digger, a very difficult, I can't remember it, it's a very difficult name, but he's done, actually, oddly, the same, it's just come out, the same kind of thing as I've been writing, because I do think that in a kind of way all writers are the same writer. They tend to be doing the same kind of thing. Now, his novel, I think, works better than mine. And it's about it's a rather tragic and yet story about an ordinary American businessman trapped on the top of the Twin Towers with his two children while, you know, they prepare for the end. Mixed up, and then it goes into personal anxieties about why he's writing this book. Is it legitimate to write this book? Can he write this book? Why can't he write this book? And a sort of background of his own life and what has led him to this. And that seems the same kind of thing that he's now doing. And I think we will see a lot more books coming out which are these sort of hybrid forms. There is a sense in which you do feel, or I certainly feel now, the novel alone is not enough. Real life in some strange way has overtaken the novel. Reality, which we all live with on television, is somehow almost overwhelms us. It's got difficult to write fiction for this reason. It's also, you feel the need for fiction is not as pure fiction in written form is not as great as it was. We have a lot of fiction on film, on screen, which actually I think fulfills the need for storytelling, though not for wisdom. The therapists in every article you read provide us with the answer to sort of who we are, what we feel. That used to be the province of the novelist, because you only knew how your neighbours behaved and how your family behaved. But now we know, really, we are much more emotionally literate than we were, and so you don't look to novels. You don't look to novels alone. There are other ways of getting that information, so you do begin to wonder, really, almost, what is the point of the contemporary novel? To which my answer has been to discuss writing while you write it, if you like.
To highly entertain as well.
And to sort of entertain, but to do something else. And as I think this will become... I mean, you already begin to read them, novels which are also... people have always done it, of course. I mean, novels, if you read... some thrillers are so informative about the Gatling gun or its modern equivalent, or the Kalashnikov, or the working of the White House, that... You know, they're very, very informative, and the writer researches. I mean, I've never done much research, but or only these days into my own life, because I would always rather invent than research. Though research, and research always seems to me the cowardly writer's way of not writing anything, you know. At the same, but it's so nice. I mean, research is wonderful. You sit there in a room sort of reading interesting things, pretending that it's work, you know. But the actual work is getting things out of your head and putting it onto a page. That's work. And so, you know, I go to W.H. Smith and I read all the thrillers that I can find on the way home, and I read the occasional other book, and on the train when I'm tired, and you move yourself into other lands, other places, other predicaments, and, you know, then you get home and you read, hopefully, a good book, and very occasionally they are.
Well, I think our students are very grateful for you for saying they don't need to do research to write.
No, why? I mean, if you can't make it up, I mean, write something else. I did do some research once. I wrote a book about cloning, and I went to a small town in Sweden to interview somebody who was trying to clone a mummy. An Egyptian mummy, and I went to see him, and they were in tandem with an East German laboratory. They were indeed trying to clone a mummy, but they said they'd stopped because they thought they could only get a 99% perfect person. Anyway, the government had asked him to stop. But he sort of, he's a terribly good-looking man, this rim, and he sort of tapped his nose and sort of shook his head, and I knew they actually hadn't stopped. They just said they were stopping. I put all this into a novel, and everybody thought it was science fiction. So I thought, you know, what's the point of doing research? Whereas the bits I had made up, they all thought were real. Real life is so much stranger than fiction that, you know, research can be a terrible trap.
I have a question in the front.
Obviously, when you're writing something, you're very much kind of focused on what you're doing at the moment. But when you look back over your whole career, which of your own works do you feel the most affection for now looking back?
Well, there's a novel called Puffball, which I wrote, which was, again, sort of oddly autobiographical, because it was about the birth of my youngest child, only it was all mixed up with rather... That was a rather odd book, because it was... I had started it, because I had this baby and knew nothing about the process, which it was 20 years ago. You didn't know anything about your own body. It's amazing how much we know now and how little we knew then. It was available, but now, you know, pregnant women know stage by stage exactly what's going on, exactly the processes of birth. But certainly when I was a girl, and even much later, it was all a mystery. And actually this book was meant to be a sort of textbook on fetal development, with a novel which was kind of demonstrating how parents are the bit part players in the children's drama, but they never know that. They think it's them, they think it's their emotions, they think all these, you know, somehow it's got nothing to do with the baby, but it is everything to do with the baby. And it was a novel about that called Puffball, and because it was about one of my children, I suppose, although in the book, he wasn't even born yet. That's the one I have the most affection for. And oddly, another small novel, not much read, because it's by a different publisher, and they let things sort of go out of print, though I see it's still selling mildly somewhere. It was called Heart of the Country, and was a novel about social security benefits in a small town of Shepton Mallet in Somerset. And I thought it would be only interesting to people who are trying to battle with housing benefit and in one part of town and child benefit in another and so on. But actually it had kind of worldwide resonance, because you discover the number of women on benefits at one time or another in their life is enormous. And it won the Los Angeles Times Fiction Prize, which I thought was rather remarkable. But I really liked that one, because it was so somehow local and pertinent. And it was about this household which had Glastonbury Tor sort of 5 miles away that way, and the Mendip mast, which was sort of an electronic, you know, one of those great big electronic things, and the sort of waves from both of them were sort of rattling and shaking this house till it sort of fell to bits. I kind of liked that image. So I liked that one.
Yes, please.
Considering your history background, what was it that made you
Yes. Well, when I came out with my degree in economics, I didn't even know what the rates were. I didn't know anything, do you know, or I knew nothing about the way the world worked, but I knew everything about the trade cycle. But it's amazing how much knowledge you can get of specific things as a student. I was just rather good at it. That's why I did it. Because you could tell, you could sort your way through, at least I could, an incredible amount of detail to get to the nub of the matter, which was seemed to be what you had to do. But I did it really because I went to St Andrews and they had a it was a 3-year degree course and one of those pre degree course things, and you had to tick five different categories. And I had to tick something in this category, which was social sciences. So I ticked economics, and as well as sort of French and English and Latin or whatever it was, and history. But you had to tick something, and I ticked economics, and then I ticked psychology. And it was just so much more interesting than anything I was doing, because I hadn't done it before. Everything else you'd been spent years and years in school doing, and then you just have to do some more. And it's really boring. Yeah. So I did economics, and I really liked it. So that was how, you know, it was... I mean, people used not to take their education seriously at all. I certainly didn't. But you know, fortuitously, you know, you end up doing these subjects. And it was useful. Yes, it was extremely useful. Oddly, statistics, which was psychology, was both the most difficult and impossible to do, but also the most... the thing that was most useful whenever you looked at any research shows document. You know, you just saw the flaws in it. And it's amazing how few flaws people still see. But the whole thing of education, of making connections, of sifting through your own thoughts, was of enormous value.
Certainly in Mantrapped, you do talk about a part in your life when you decided you did not want to become a writer, and you have that statement, but thankfully you changed your mind.
Well, I don't think you changed your mind. I mean, I didn't, again, I mean, when I was young, writing was not a career. It was sort of something you did, and if you had any energy or strength, it might possibly earn you some money. But my family, I came from a long line of novelists who did... you know, who had some acknowledgement in the world, but who struggled financially all the time. So it wasn't anything odd for me to do, because the family, people in the family did it. It wasn't something you wanted to do, because they did so badly, you know. I really just wanted to to get married and do nothing. You know. It was not to be, you know. But again, that was what you were kind of supposed to do, or that was what society was set up to enable you to do. But it didn't work like that in real life. Seldom does.
I'll take a question from the back.
Writing is a terrifically practical business. You don't set out, at least I never set out to write anything at all. You find yourself writing it for a whole set of reasons. The children's books, there were only two children's books. The first one, because I had a publisher, my publisher was my boyfriend, and I didn't have any money, and he said, "Why don't you write a children's story? You can get £3,000 for it." So I wrote it, and he looked at it and read it and said, "I don't think much of this." And we didn't really speak again. But I did actually have the story, and then I sold it to my publishers, who were sort of really very fond of me at the time. And sort of, you know, children's stories are meant to be, or then when, you know, 20 years ago, when life was much easier for everybody. Do you know, they published it out of a kind of courtesy to me, and then, you know, it did quite well and got reprinted and got sold in America a bit. And the other story was because a friend of my husband's, who later transpired to be more than a friend, but I didn't know that at the time. I mean, you see, life is so peculiar, really. And she had just had ignored, being a rather drastic kind of person, she had ignored the doctor's warning and had lost the sight in one eye because she didn't take any notice of a slipped retina. And I was really sorry for her. And she said, "Couldn't you write me a story that I could illustrate, you see?" And I said, "Oh, well, all right." And I said, "What are you good at drawing?" And she said, "Dogs and machinery." So I wrote a story called Wolf the Mechanical Dog, which did really well, which sort of got translated and sold here and there and then vanished away. It was a sort of science fiction story. But, you know, this is how you come to write children's fiction, you see, because you can write something, people ask you to, and you respond. It's not a sort of career choice. It's very difficult doing children's writing, actually. It's a different kind of. It's a different. I mean, all these things. I write in all kinds of forms, but you learn it. It's almost as if you. It's another program on the computer. There's a sort of review short of computer. You know, you learn the first one you do of anything takes ages, and it's really difficult for the first few times. Then you suddenly realize how it is done, and if you have to write a short story, you put the short story disc in, you know, and if you have to write a children's story. You put that one in, but with rather reluctantly, because it is difficult and it is time-consuming. And it is a matter of getting everything in actually exact time sequence, which is far more difficult than you might suppose. You have to do things, and you have to do this in adult fiction, and that's one of the ways you go wrong, I think, is that you... You know, it's like... I keep reading manuscripts other people send me, and they all sort of seem to start with a phrase like, walking towards the window, she felt or suffered or did something. But you can't do that in children. You're not doing something while you're doing something else. She walked to the window, she thought something or other. They're separate things, and you have to keep them, especially in children's minds, very separate. And then... You almost have to film it in your mind and then just go from one stage to the other very carefully. But there's a whole, you know, I mean, there are ways of doing it, but I don't know them. You have to do it from first principles, I think, nearly everything. And I know a lot of you here are probably doing creative writing, and this is not, you know, they will tell you what to do. But I don't. I never, you know, you, in a way it's easier just to do it yourself. I mean, to do it from first principles.
Yes, please.
You're very bold in some of your choices of stories, like the one you told us about with Soul Swap. Do you find that some of them just dry up and you can't go any further? Because you are very brave.
Well, the soul swap was very difficult, and gender swap is far more difficult, I think. And I mean, actually, I write about that within the text itself, about the sort of almost impossibility of some themes that you can tincture, but there seems to be an odd barrier, not with science fiction or anything like that, though that too that is usually based in some in a sort of reality, although it's a projected reality into the future. But if you do something that doesn't happen, it's really hard to do. There seems to be a kind of barrier between you and it, and there was, but you know, you still push it, and then you know, and then you're never quite convinced you've done it properly, or you have left things undone which you ought to have done, which is very much in the writer's mind, I think. It's all really rather simpler than one supposes. You just take the fairly obvious next step. And having embarked on this scheme. But you see, again, there's the kind of whole thing of synchronicity, of being aware or open to what is going to happen next, or being awake to what, although you're, is what is going on in your own unconscious. In fact, this book came in such an odd way that I started doing the sort of soul swap, gender swap book. And then I ran into trouble, but it started very differently from this one. I mean, it was about different people altogether, but the same thing. So I stopped doing it and told my publishers, who seemed to loom large in my life, you'll notice. I told my publishers I wasn't going to do it, I'd do them something else. And they said rather reluctantly, oh, well, all right, we suppose you know what you're doing, which is not totally clear to me. So I stopped doing what I was doing. Then they sent me the jib out, and I started. Then I went back to the second version of the autobiography, the second stage of the autobiography, which was what they wanted, and started writing that. And then the cover for the original jacket, the cover for the original book came in, because the design department hadn't been told by the editorial department. Yeah, tell you, it's terribly practical. The editorial department hadn't passed on to the design department that this book was not going to be written. But it doesn't stop design departments from rightly doing the covers of books, which they haven't read. I mean, you know, that doesn't even enter into their ideas anymore, that you would need to read the book before you did the jacket. And I think I was rather taken aback by this, but also kind of challenged at looking at this not very good jacket, though this one's a nice jacket. And so I thought, well, you know, here I am then, apparently in their heads, writing two books at the same time, which is not something I usually do. Therefore, I will do them both. And so I fed the one into the other and ended up with this hybrid, which was more satisfactory than doing either on their own. So although it is accidental, you can see, you know, you have to go with the pattern of the times, really, and see what happens. And then you do your sort of professional best to make it work.
Yes, please.
Toby Litt was here for a reading last week, and he supported that storytelling in novels should not be made the same way as in movies, very much related to imagery, trying to convey the character's interiority through images, and more so trying to write in a very descriptive way about the character's thoughts in a more psychological way.
Well, they just seem to me to be different enterprises. I do quite a lot of film work and television work as well. They're very different. Film, you have to make the meaning of everything apparent through the plot and through what you see. You can't, which is sort of quite fun in a way. You don't give them much subtext. I mean, the subtext is from what they move, you know, what they do, or what, you know, is to do with props largely, but novels. In novels, I mean, in film, the director is the voice. The director is saying, and he points his camera at something, or the editor is most important. When they say, this is what you should be paying attention to, this is what you pay attention to. If you're writing a novel, you're writing about what people think, what people feel, all kinds of other things, what they look like, which is a kind of hook that you hang plot on. I mean, and so you need not to ignore that, I think. But they're different exercises. In novels are actually easier, I think, just like novels are easier than short stories, really, because they're longer and you don't have to be so controlled. But you have to, in film, you tell the story through the director's eyes. In the novel, you can tell it through who, you know, you can be God speaking. You can be I. You can write a Dear Reader book in which you fictionalize the writer. But there is a person telling you this story. In film, you're presented with something different, and it does not. Stage is the thing that engages your attention and your imagination most, I think, and still does, because you have a sort of whole tableau in front of you, and you, the individual person in the audience, is picking out who you're going to pay attention to. And though the actors are very skilled in making sure you pay attention to them, or the director is making sure that, you know, you look where you're meant to look. You're still given a kind of choice. In film, you're given very little choice as to what you're going to think is important. I mean, you know, if it's showing a beautiful landscape, then you're saying this is important in it. If you describe a beautiful landscape, it's really more difficult, especially nowadays, because the film is a kind of shorthand. I mean, those long descriptive passages in Victorian novels, it always seems to me, is because they were pre-photographs. And so nobody knew, and you had a few engravings or paintings. But otherwise, most people who read a novel would never have seen a mountain or know what it looked like. Therefore, you had to tell people what it was like, and they did at great length, and to us rather boring length. but it had to be done, and no doubt it doesn't bore us, but it bored them. I mean, readers move on. I mean, you know, just like writers move on. But I think what I find, if people send me stories or manuscripts again, you find, especially if they're young, they somehow believe there is a design department and a casting department who's done it all for them. And so, you know, you will go straight into he said and she had, he said, without having the slightest knowledge of who he or she is or what their outlook is or what nation they come from or what age they are, because everybody always assumes that the person they're writing about is the same age as they are, which sometimes are. So that's the other thing. You do need in novels, you do need, as in films, you set scenes and you have no... you have no casting person there to choose the characters. You choose them, the writer.
Two questions. Yes, please.
You spoke a couple of times about 20 years ago, it's been to be easier. Do you mean that 20 years ago it was easier to present an idea and have it accepted, and now we're in a situation where the market is dictating before it even gets off the ground?
Yeah. Yes, I mean, in fact, I think both things are true. I mean, both from the sort of writing point, you know, you used to know what was up and what was down. You used to know what was good, what was bad, what was left, what was right. You no longer know that. You used to suppose that the world went on in exactly the same way as it had, really, basically, for the last 50 years. You no longer know that. It's all up for grabs somehow. There's that, which makes the actual writing difficult, I think. And then so far as the market is concerned, yes. I mean, you know, marketing, mostly, not always, marketing departments rule the roost. And they don't always get it right. That's the other thing. Fortunately, they know they don't always get it right. And you can't be too despairing about this. That you know, people who write well and have something to say and have something of interest to others do get their work published usually. Because anyone who writes well sort of leaps off the page, actually, I think. And you know, editorial departments don't have no power. But you know, I mean, the world is full of rave rejections. Do you know? In which people write novels, which is an incredible undertaking and achievement, to do so much work, so much trouble. It shouldn't be laborious. It should be more fun, really. I do think this. You do need to enjoy what you do, but not enjoy it to such an extent that you don't take any notice of what your readers might enjoy too. It's a kind of, you know, it's a marriage between reader and writer, I think. But still, things get published which they don't think will sell, but actually do sell. But there are also a lot of things which 10, 15, 20 years ago would have been published without any question. That sort of middle ground is people find it very difficult to get published. But then, you see, I think we went through a time when it was almost too easy to get published, and people's novel before the first one, before the publishable one, would get published, and then they'd have trouble writing another one, whereas actually, had the first one been put away, on which you had honed your skills. I mean, presumably, you know, in creative writing courses enable you to hone your skills before you have to do all this much, the actual work of writing an entire novel. I don't know.
I'll take one final question from the back.
Yes, you spoke about the need to fictionalise autobiographical details from a pragmatic point of view. Particularly like the idea of fictionalising your own sister from making your own story. I just wonder if you thought there's any benefit to the work, sort of, apart from, you know, pragmatics, if it actually enriches the work to fictionalise.
Well, I think you do get a kind of feeling you want to pass it on in some way. You want to actually hand over the benefit of your own experience, and you know that if you do it straight, nobody will take the slightest notice. So you have to sort of do it in a more roundabout way, and then because this is what happened, and because you do, you do get a notion that you do begin to realize that what happens to you is difficult of what is happening to everybody. You do realize that although as you live through your own life, you have the feeling that you're in charge of it. You're not. Society is in charge of it. You're much more impressed, really, by what a certain generation of friends say than you imagine. Do you know, the boyfriend they approve of is, you know, 10 years past is going to be different from the one they approve of now. And it's even sort of little things like that which then dictate your actions at a certain time. You realise it's sort of socially conditioned. And it seems you would like people to be aware of this, I suppose. So that's sort of why you do it, in fact. I hadn't realised, until I started writing Auto da Fé, I hadn't realised to what extent this was true. You think you're it's a rather deconstructionist way of looking at it. You think you're writing it, actually, you're not.
Well, we've run out of time, but please do come and ask questions and bring your copies because you will be signing books.
Sure. Yes.
And I just wanted to mention that the bookshop has a stand outside, and they're offering 10% and 3 for 2 on Faye Welton's novels just for tonight. Also, in a couple of weeks, Elizabeth Smither will be reading from her latest collection of poetry, so I do hope you can join us then. But for now, please join me in thanking Faye Welton for this
one. Can I just say something which I was instructed to say, and so I must say it, that if any of you saw Life and Us of a She-Devil on the telly, it's now available on DVD. And, so there you are.